You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is the 8th of December, 2021. This has been a very busy Christmas season for me. Busier seasons are much better than less busy seasons. It means there's a greater community for you to work within. It's extremely important to build social trust, to build every kind of network we could imagine, to fight the insanity that we're dealing with. Today I want to talk about a topic that I've been dealing with for a very long time. I want to talk about the Russian Spring. Russian Donbass, because it's now front page news as the Johnson's Law cause of Western anger against Russia, or at least today's cause. As always, everything about what's being printed is mythology, tightly centered in the monopoly press. But another reason I want to talk about the Russian Spring, or the revolution against liberal Kiev, Ukraine in 2014, is that it's a white pill for a lot of us. It was an example of those openly calling for social nationalism as a state ideology, separated from any deeply corrupt, increasingly third world country, and created, well, despite being war torn, a very proud nation, part of the Russian nation. And the ideology that motivated this movement is the center of what I want to talk about today. I've dealt with this many times before. The fact that they've been able to defeat globalization's army and attempt to build their own society, and even today, 2014 to today, is still happening. It was an incredible revolutionary event. This was a violent uprising against two things: the imposition of the Ukrainian language on a Russian-speaking area, and the attempt to essentially privatize the entire country, selling it off for debt repayment, which was the entire point of the coup in 2014. Those in Novorossiya, Donbass, Donetsk, whatever you want to call it, New Russia, are overwhelmingly a industrial urban population that under no circumstances has lost its peasant roots. We know how healthy they are because they rebelled against the liberal juggernaut that the U.S. was imposing on Ukraine. And that wasn't imposed on them. We all know Ukraine is not an independent country. It is a colony of the United States and the EU. I should even say it's really a colony of BlackRock. It's private sources of capital that matter. Ukraine is an independent country in the same sense that Joe Biden is president of the USA. But this was an ideological war. All of the wars we deal with, nationalism versus individualism, globalism, and whatever name you want to use, are deeply ideological. And not a whole lot of people comprehend what's happening there. Their use of Soviet imagery frightens a lot of people. But that's eccentric. It comes from the fact that this industrial area of eastern Ukraine did very well under the Soviet system, even in the 60s and 70s. Massive investments went in there and it collapsed, almost collapsed entirely, in the 90s. Let me put it this way. The rate of growth was not nearly what it was in the Soviet era. The only profitable functioning part of Ukraine was in the Donetsk general area, the Donbas area. That's why it was so important that the forces of globalization working through Kiev were able to grab it and then liquidate it. They would have deindustrialized the region by now. You have a group of people who were very, apparently very healthy, very nationalist. You know, they're kind of an outpost of the Russian identity. Think of how nationalist the Falkland Islanders are, partially distance and being, you know, alone has a lot to do with it. You know, there's no greater British patriot than a Northern Islander. But the aggression that's imposed against us and those like us is ideological. At its root, ideas are determinant. But few understand the relations. The concept of New Russia is a urban industrial population, firmly Orthodox, firmly royalist. The pictures of Nicholas II are everywhere, and they're in the same, you know, room with pictures of Lenin, which is very odd, but vaguely understandable. Used to working together. They have military training because they had the draft. I can't stress the significance here. Now, this group of people took up arms against the imposition both of Ukrainian language and privatization. And they defeated the Ukrainian army, which was very... So you want to have an enemy, have it be the Ukrainian army. They fell to pieces, which is why the U.S. is pouring money and material into that country. Most of the POWs that the Novorossians took were Georgians or Latvian. They were not from the area. This is a people who are highly, highly motivated. And they defeated, throughout the course of late 2014, they defeated the Ukrainian army to the absolute outrage of the liberal establishment, of course. This is one of these times where you actually had a very legitimate popular uprising. It was a explosion of energy. You can't fight with such an idea. You can't win against a motivated group of people like this. What happened in the Donbas is what had echoes everywhere. And it should be taken very seriously. And the U.S. is pouring money into Ukraine, and then Ukraine is hoping to invade Donbas and thereby possibly invite Russian intervention and hence World War III. I'm not sure the U.S. is ever going to take on regular forces. There has never been any Russian invasion. There hasn't been, and there isn't going to be. Not when their own militia forces are doing very well. It's the only invasion in the world that, the only invasion in the world no one noticed. The invasion story was actually invented by the Ukrainian high command. I have this elsewhere, but, generals were abandoning their posts. They were abandoning their men, several in particular. And to cover for themselves, they were claiming that they were fighting Russian regulars. And that way, their defeat was understandable. That's where the invasion came from. There is no further evidence than that. But any kind of revolutionary movement that's capable of doing this to an established state has to be focused. And ideology has to embody the ideas in the population as a whole. It can't contradict who they are. Maximize mobilization, especially in this case where you had a military threat. It's ideology of national salvation. The movement was based on Russian ethno-nationalism. They were part of the Russian world and Russian space. And they ultimately sought reunification with Russia as a whole. The exact timing doesn't make any difference, but they are Orthodox in every respect and Russians in every respect. Really, there can only really be two identities. There's a Russian and there's a Ukrainian. Today, no one wants to build a Donbass identity. No one wants to build a Donbass ethnicity. No one wants to build an Ulster ethnicity. Or a Falklands ethnicity. They need to ally with a much powerful partner or else they're going to be crushed. The point, of course, of the Ukrainian attack against Novorossiya is to drive Russia out of the air. But the drive for national reunification is the engine here. It led to streams of volunteers to the Donbass from Russia and elsewhere. And many did die for it. But Novorossiya can't exist without Russia. Or even in the short term, they are not separated from the Russian mainstream at all. It's certainly not a closed system. I mean, this was the export center of the Ukrainian economy prior to 2014. This is where well over 50%, I think something like 75% of the export earnings came from. If you separate Novorossiya from Ukraine, their economic system is crushed by at least 6%. There's nothing left. So it ends up just being this Western-financed kernel of anti-Russian anger. It has having no other purpose than that. But revolutions like this, and successful one, didn't just come out of nowhere. For 25 years, there was an attack on their ethno-identity. Everything that they thought was true turned out to be false. Everything they thought was false turned out to be true. Or pretended as true, I should say. They were living in an unnatural environment. Memory of their ancestors going back to the Cossack era were constantly under attack. But I do definitely want to make it clear, in addition to that, that their use of the term fascist has to be put in context. Fascist for them is anything that comes from the West as a colonizing force. So capitalism would automatically be fascism. There could be there was a homosexual rally in Kiev. That was then considered an expression of fascism. That's obviously not how we use the term. The same thing for the Soviet Union. The so-called Great Patriotic War, which was a disaster for everybody, is one of the defining myths of this country. And it has nothing to do with the defeat, necessarily, of Germany. It has to do with the spirit of a people. I don't think Stalin's victory was exactly a good thing. It's ridiculous. The Donbass mentality is to fight and to build. Great Patriotic War, which was not great and not patriotic, accepted both and exemplified it. You take it in the abstract, connecting it with other battles in history, regardless of the two sides, the fighting spirit is what meant. There's very close connection between New Russia and National Socialism. It is a National Socialist movement, although they can never use that. They'll never make that connection. So the so-called Great Victory is at the core. It's one of these things that Putin talks about it all the time. It's not one of my favorite aspects of this movement. The only thing is, of course, Himmler, had Himmler gotten his way, it would have been a big problem for Slavs. That I agree with. But we all know, and I've said this many times, Hitler knew he wasn't going to win that war. He invaded to save the West. He didn't have the material, he didn't have the men to hold that place for at all. But there's a lot more to it. The mentality, you know, the Great Patriotic War of 1812. The war against the Poles, Minin and Paharski. There's so many things that it's the fighting spirit in general. That's, they're exceptionally martial people. But this is essentially the sacralization of the fighting spirit. There is no pacifism there. They see the USSR at a time when their economy exploded. Something like 50% of the coal in the entire Soviet Union came from there. But a little bit less than that of the metallurgy. This tiny little area had the Soviet Union really dependent on it. Now, we don't like the USSR. It was a wicked empire. But from their point of view, it was what brought them to international prominence. And so they built their own state, they built their own institutions. You know, whenever you're building something, you take metaphysical ideas and you make them operationalizable. You make them, you institutionalize it. Take information and make them routine. A clear system of orienting people, giving them unambiguous and clear guidelines regarding who they are. And essentially, you know, as Dugin says, it should be a dogmatic system. This is who we are. The left has done very well with this. The same thing with education and training. This is where discipline comes from. And culture, elite and otherwise. But this is one and the same mission. Not to destroy, but to build. But this is exactly what's going on in Russian Donbass. It's considered now almost a sacred place because of what's happened there. It's very small. It's critically small. But the state apparatus is only temporary because this is going to go one day into the Russian orbit entirely. Donbass is really a small Russia. It's a small Russian island with the exact same civilizational ideas as the Russian continent as such. A tremendous historical dignity. So I don't want to get bound up with the Soviet element. There's a very specific economic reason for that. For them, the Soviet era was far better than the 1990s, which may well, from their point of view, be absolutely true. This country came into existence because of the liberal globalist running Ukraine at the time. This aggression, this ideological aggression, this linguistic aggression, this economic aggression, release would have been pent up for a very long time. As I've said before, they demanded national socialism, not just socialism, they demanded national socialism. They demanded the total nationalization of the property of the oligarchs. They demanded state industries, remain state industries. They demanded the return of the property that belongs to labor, not the what was privatized by the Judaic oligarchy. And they, as a popular element, which you could do in a small space, build a state that any of these usurious parasitism will be excluded in the future. This was a clear support for not just socialism, but the national version. The attempt to build capitalism in the Russian world, this clearly isn't the first time. You know, in 1917, certainly was the case too. Capitalism is based not only on economics, but on the Protestant idea. And Dugin talks about this quite often. The basis of the entire capitalist system is the cult of personal enrichment at any cost. And you may not deny this. Now, this modern project we know is dying. The modern project gave birth to capitalism. And it held that man is at the same time fundamentally incorrigible on the one hand, but rational on the other. That cannot be changed, and therefore his vices have to be put to the service of the common good. His vices have to be put to the driving force of progress. So if it does exist, it's a very weird kind of morality. It's the same morality organized crime. The common interest or the sum of personal interests is nonsense. The goal of National Socialism is idealistic. I'm talking about National Socialism, not initially Hitlerianism, but the concept in general. It's idealistic in the sense that ultimately the synthesis of justice and freedom has to be reached. But capitalism, of course, is strictly individual. Multiply capital, maximize profit. There is no way to reconcile them. The capitalism doesn't come out of anywhere either. Capitalism was born in a religious perversion. Capitalism grew out of the tradition of Calvinism. The Calvinist movement initially, in the Reformation period, actually made the point that the goal of the true Christian life is to work hard and acquire wealth. The criterion, believe it or not, of divine grace, within the framework of the ethical concept, was the amount of money. The more money, the more divine grace. They use Abraham and several others as an example here, and Solomon, of course. So Max Weber also said that he admired Calvin and said that Calvin endowed the modern businessman with a clear conscience. Of course, I would say that Darwin did that as well. And I've said this 100 times. Darwinism can't be separated from 19th century Britain. Middle of the 19th century, Britain was not only industrializing rapidly, but building an empire based on that industrialization. If competition and the victory of one species over another over time is what drives nature, then both what the empire does abroad and the industrialists do at home is perfectly not only normal but praiseworthy. To destroy competition due to superior adaptability and then consolidate. So Max Weber, say he didn't say this about Darwin, but Calvin, he endowed the modern entrepreneur with a crystal clear conscience. But I want to say that Darwin had a harder role in that. Today, the amount of money that someone has is the nature of a person's worth. It's not just a public thing, it's an existential thing. But the origin of the money, it doesn't matter. Anyway, a thief or murderer, it doesn't matter. Money automatically imparts wisdom and intelligence. There is a holiness to it. It is a talisman, and there was civilizations that had money talismans. The pagan temples were always banks in Mesopotamia and in even in the Greek civilization. But the point of all that is that it's completely incompatible with everything Russian, whether it be national, civilizational, at any level. There is no connection. This is why Orthodoxy has such a tough time in the Western world, because what's considered middle-class respectability is sin. And anyone trying to force the church into a middle-class mold is to be nice about it, misguided. But the problem is, all civilizations had a communal foundation. Individualism is a perversion of the 19th century. Thomas Hobbes, of course, the founder of modernism, theorized that in the state of nature nonsense, which I go into other places, it's a myth that justified everything that came afterwards. But all civilization, including colonial America, were intensely communalist. The war in eastern Ukraine wiped out much of the economy. In a certain way, not to mention, of course, there was a full sanctions and blockade put on it by the Ukrainian state, despite the Ukrainians being far worse off than Russia was. But that's a way to use the militancy of the war and this kind of blank slate to start over again. And it's exactly the sort of mentality that goes into fighting a war that can rebuild a country. Soldiers working together, industrialists working together. So a form of social nationalism probably has three things in a practical level. The mobilization of economic potency and placing it at the service of the state and society as a whole. That would include the nationalization of large and semi-large enterprises. And the commune, and not the collective agriculture, but the communal agriculture. The restoration of, you know, what we call social consumption funds. To be free education, that kind of thing. And to liquidate the criminal oligarchic structure that cannot be integrated into the state fabric of the state. It's false, it's dangerous. They'll pursue their own interests anyway. This is a diseased part of the population. That's a minimum. The fight against oligarchy, anti-national capital, doesn't, of course, mean the war against private capital as such. Private initiative is a great thing. And this can't be denied. And even it was under Khrushchev, because before him, private entrepreneurship in Soviet Russia existed unofficially, even during the war. At the height of the Stalin era, most of the boots of the Red Army were made by private cooperatives. But a small entrepreneur is not an enemy. Places like Italy, it's a small entrepreneur that holds the whole economy together. Small owner, small landowner, the colonial idea in America was independent. It was based on hard work. It was based on communal identity. It was based on the extended family. To turn him into a capitalist is a complete mutation. It's a mutation of his mentality. Profit ends up becoming more important than the nation that gave birth to him. There's a line crossed. There's a certain level of wealth or notoriety that's crossed that then forces you to become a part of the regime. A thin red line, as we used to say. But there is a tremendous danger. The concentration of capital is the problem. Transformation of the small entrepreneur into a capitalist happens when capital is simply too concentrated. And the state in Russia and elsewhere, National Socialism prevents this at all costs. Preventing the concentration of capital in fewer and fewer hands at a certain level is what states really should be doing. The whole point is to reset everything. Concentration always leads to corruption and the denigration of the state itself. This is why the state is separated from the economy. It doesn't have to be. But when corporate capital touches it, it destroys it. Oligarchy is the enemy of anything good and decent. It is an evil that that few people fully understand. It has a personality. It has to be eliminated at all costs. But there's many other things, of course. But, you know, the Russian Donbass, Orthodoxy played a huge role here. The revolution took place, or the counter-revolution, I should say, in 2014 took place. There was a resurgence in the church. And for the same thing as I mentioned before, they had been taught for so long that this stuff isn't true. They were taught by the communists that it wasn't true. They were taught by the capitalists that it wasn't true. The nightmare of the 1990s was overwhelming. The economy shrank by 80%. The country went into total default. The currency was worthless. State structures were completely destroyed. And in Ukraine, unlike Russia or Belarus, it was never restored. It's a nightmare of injustice. It's a nightmare of materialism. So the counter-revolution, since it had rejected certain aspects, many aspects of Soviet socialism and capitalism, the church itself was the beneficiary of this. Spirituality became a central core to the new Russian idea. I've come across people who have been there who say that the churches is the one thing that's always bustling. It's revolutionary Donbass, it's called. And there's a definite, sincere, very working class devotion. And it was very serious. And there was, for example, closing nightclubs and brothels and the drug dens. Places of alien sex, like Christian Scientists, were shut down. This is the campaign. This is the with more or less a spontaneous campaign during this revolution. The Orthodox Church of the Donbass is extremely important. It's still rebuilding, of course, and understanding itself relative to the revolution just a few years ago. A few decades ago, there were something like 10 priests in the entire Donbass, and many of them with bishops who were not, shouldn't even be dealing with. But things are growing, has always been growing. Even during the war, every single parish stayed open. Now, Orthodoxy is central here. We're talking about the total full scale between the state and the church, not only in catechism, but also in merging these two entities. Missionary work is very important, including in the army. State information should always be have a spiritual root. But aggression in the spiritual realm from the West is an equal problem. There is a demolition of traditional Orthodoxy going on. And the Ukrainian, so-called Ukrainian church, has been ecumenist and liberal from the very beginning. And the closer it gets to Western sources, the worse it's going to get. To the extent that the liberal ideology comes from Protestant individualism, and many of the Protestant churches are connected with neocon interests in the West, this is why they're a problem. This is why Putin's law on forbidding money coming from abroad is extremely important. It's not just a matter of financing. It's rebuilding society. I always said that conversion is taking your present life, tearing it apart, seeing every piece of it, now putting it back together with God in mind. And this is the same thing here. The campaign, as I mentioned, to close the brothels and the nightclubs, and some of them have reopened, but these campaigns were spontaneous. If they don't get translated into state policy, it can stay at the private level, but, and the same for drugs. First 6 months of the counter-revolution, 2014, the drug trade was smashed with violence. Brutal, uncompromising. But it has returned. Without that revolutionary fervor, nothing's going to happen. The same fervor that created a victorious revolution against Ukrainian liberalism, on the one hand, can create positive social results like this on the other. It's the same mentality. It could be whether in the factory, whether in the farm, whether in church. One of the great victories here is the idea that people are used to working together. You have a tightly packed population. Tremendous amount of social trust. With social trust, as almost every social science article has ever stated, is based on homogeneity. It's extremely important to understand. But without the spiritual element, ideological action doesn't have much meaning. It ends up being hypocrisy. The other thing that was manifest in this revolution that now the West has fully declared war on, is communalism. And I'm not talking about collectivism. I'm talking about communalism. The metaphor of the extended family in social relation. What we have is not only the artificial atomization, as we talked about many times, and it's gone very far and it's destroyed personal relationships. Relationships are almost impossible now because of the egocentrism that's now justified. But even the individual is under attack. The unity of the individual is being broken down. This is not an abstract question. Community requires trust. Trust requires ethnic nationalism. It requires a single language and single mentality. This is why the language issue was so important. Trying to force Ukrainian on a Russian-speaking area for the interest of a handful of oligarchs that control the Western economy is not something that's going to work. The communal principle, of course, in Russia is very strong. Everything individualist is anathema in the Slavic mentality, but this is the case everywhere. But Russia remains the standard in this regard right now. The individual is unpredictable. You can't forecast and design anything with the individual. Of course, markets are created. Markets are invented, not responded to. There's nothing chaotic about the so-called free market. It's created. The restoration, though, of communalism is a very high priority. Ideology, state building is right. It's right in the middle. The very structure of the state has to be built on this. It has to be built on a model of state that would ensure the implementation of these ideas that occurred that won the victory in 2014. Communalism is based not only on obeying but also commanding. It's a constant give and take. Without the social trust of the industrial economy and the single language of one ethnic group, it can't be done. Western democracy has to go under any circumstance. Western democracy is a creation of industrialization. It is not designed for any kind of communal society. I've spoken on Daily Nationalist on Thanksgiving. The one I did myself. By the way, I'm going to do another one by myself Thursday, tomorrow. I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet, but I went through a laundry list of things that was assumed by the writers of the Constitution, American Constitution. And it was not the mass society that we have now. Liberal democracy means that politicians are blamed by those, for any, when everything goes wrong, by the powers that's true power or private capital. It's the rule of private capital using politicians as smokescreens. This one was the case in Florence, Italy in the Renaissance. It's the case in Ukraine and in America today. And so the so-called human rights agenda is absolutized within this ideology. At least human rights for some people. The rights of one individual become the priority of the rights of the whole society, which means that there is no social fabric left, which you can't have in a country that's under constant threat. Now, the idea that's come up many times is subornos, conciliarity. Councils that existed throughout the Tsarist era, and even in certain places in the Soviet system, at least maybe the first few years of its existence. In the Tsarist era, you had a single vertically and horizontally integrated mechanism of what we might call direct democracy. Society was based on these communal entities. And those communal entities was how the state functioned. And the local commune was at the core. The Tsarist commune, and it should be today, be given the maximum authority for self-government, including law enforcement functions, where the sheriff kind of came from. It's not initially the British idea, but and the entire structure should be based on the communal idea. And this is a part of the new Russian ideology. And you had a similar system in Libya under Gaddafi. And of course, you also have a permanent people's militia. It was a popular, relatively spontaneous creation of these militia forces that defeated the Ukrainian army and the mercenaries. You feel sorry for those guys when you read about them. It's extremely important. But these are the foundations of what New Russia is. National reunification, the church, and communalism. Now, I mentioned that the mission and goal of the new Russian revolution is union with Russia. And I think the overwhelming majority of people, leaders in this movement, are want to see integration into the Russian system. Not to mention, of course, in security. They're connected in a very long period of time. But there's a few ways to do this. And this is one of the things that threatens the West in many ways. One idea is to federalize Ukraine. You know, the Russian language acquires a certain status in one place, Ukraine in another. And regions become autonomous. That's what the whole Party of Regions was based on. Now, it's a much older idea. And then, you know, you have regional blocks economically and otherwise, with some kind of forum for mutual interaction. I think that's silly at this point. No, a separate state, what we have now, and a very early entry into the customs union or the Eastern trading bloc, and to develop their specific, very specific gifts as they did in the Soviet era. And then an independent new Russia then becomes a part of Russia very quickly. Then immediate reunification, which was like the Crimean referendum. And they become essentially subjects of the Russian Federation overnight. There is no chance of preserving a unitary Ukraine. I mean, someone likes to go to Podzi, as I've said before, coming in. Actual nationalism rather than this cosmopolitan nonsense, parading is nationalism. And of course, the removal of oligarchy, you know, it's possible, but unlikely at the moment. And the resources simply aren't there right now. It would have to have, you know, Russian language as a second state language, but the entire 2014 coup of the West against Yanukovych was based on Ukrainian language and pushing the Russians out. That's the entire point of this. And it's in Russia's interest. You're going to see a sharp, and this is part of the problem here. The westernized, Russia will see an increase in its capabilities militarily. This has been written in many places now. You have Russian bomber aircraft in Crimea, and having Nova Russia is extremely important. Water and electricity in Crimea, that problem will be resolved. Then Moldova will be a neighbor, connected to the customs union, which, of course, is where they belong. And the rest of Ukraine is now partially encircled by the Russians. You know, and it becomes an example for other regions wanting to do the same thing. Importantly, strengthening the ruble is definitely come out of this integration. Because you have a tremendous industry that can be built and rebuilt there, and a history of it. The Russian economy will get better as a result of this, just like it was in the Soviet era. You know, Novorossiya comes into the customs union, the ruble's currency, recovery of effective demand there, replacement of supplies from central and western Ukraine, etc., will lead to an increase of a market for Russian producers. Gas transport industry, total control over gas pipelines to Romania and Moldova. There can't be any Ukrainian blackmail against gas importation to Europe. Now, let's be very clear. Much of what's happening in terms of American foreign policy in Ukraine is based on the natural gas and oil pipelines. Nord Stream 2, which goes through the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany, is offering much less expensive gas for all of Europe, who's struggling right now in that department. They're looking at shortages. Prices are going up. Russia is offering a solution. The West cannot handle this. They're threatening anyone having anything to do with this project. It cuts Ukraine out. It cuts the Baltics out. It cuts a lot of Western elite. It cuts the EU out in many ways. Germany, of course, continuing to have problems with the problems with the EU, and is really doing its own thing in terms of foreign policy. You know, when Crimea came over, salaries in Russia are far higher than Ukraine. So the minute they were paid in rubles, you saw an automatic increase in income. Even military men, you know, three or four times higher than in Ukraine. And then when this first, you know, in 2014, Crimea was going to increase the salaries of its state employees, connected, integrating with the Russian level. Far superior to anything that Ukraine can offer right now. So almost right away, the minimum wage in Crimea went up 20% after the referendum. And it was gradual in some places, immediate in other places. And of course, the regime in Kiev has frozen any increase in salaries and wages. And they're planning, as they always do, mass layoffs of civil servants. Becoming a part of Russia means a very different life. You know, in Ukraine right now, you have a massive rise in basic products. Cost rise in basic products. High cost of energy, high taxes. And the lack, really, of the regime's ability to subsidize anybody. If gas prices are low, the Russian market is preserved in financial assistance received from Russia, even more so if Nova Russia joins Russia. Where taxes are lower, the economy is stable, and the state support is very high, prices can be kept at a comfortable level. And of course, importantly, ending the discrimination in Ukraine against the Russian language media. There's a whole list of TV stations and books that are not permitted into Ukraine, and importing them into Ukraine is a crime. This is extremely important. Integration into Russia would be a nightmare for the regime. You'd see a huge increase in the budgets of the regions of Nova Russia, especially in the case of joining Russia. Again, the budget in the Crimea doubled upon taking the ruble as their currency. They don't have to do anything and have a huge increase in incomes due to the fact they don't have they don't have to subsidize Western and Central Ukraine, which is what they've been doing. A massive amount of money that the East creates in Ukraine. Now they don't have to do that. The money is going elsewhere, going locally now. And every year, 14, 15, so they have massive budget cuts in the Kiev government. I've said many times before that the Chinese have come into Crimea offering many investment projects, same thing for Afghanistan now. Being a part of that union and that bloc is in the interest of everyone in Ukraine, let alone the East. This entire thing in 2014 was based on the regime demanding Ukraine join the EU rather than the customs union. Joining the EU would have cost them a fortune to reform themselves, to be members, a massive more than they could ever afford. The customs union wasn't much of anything. They were already working that way. And they actually want Ukrainian goods. The Ukraine that's left doesn't produce anything that anyone wants. Now, in the Eastern world, it would have been a different story. You know, New Russia is a high-tech area. And of course, it's oriented to the Russian and to a lesser extent, the Chinese market. So cooperation with Russia is very important. But in Europe, no one needs any more high-tech product. It would just be undesirable. It doesn't fit European technological standards anyway. It can't be integrated into production chains. But only cooperation with Russian enterprises guarantees the industrial high-tech center of that economy. Not to mention a massive decrease in prices of raw materials. And you have direct assistance investments from Russia and unhindered access to the huge Russian market. Now, I've been asked recently about the demographic crisis. And there's been, due to deindustrialization, degradation of social infrastructure, there's been a tremendous loss of population over 23 years. Integration with the customs union, their victory, can create some kind of normality in their economy. Increase in salaries, pensions, as I've said, and population growth, therefore, increase, especially if they adopt the Russian program of subsidizing children. There's a migration of Russians to Novorossiya. They purchase real estate. And you even have deserters from Ukraine. All this can rebuild the economy. Degradation of social infrastructure, as we call it, leads to the decline in fertility compared to elsewhere. The development of social infrastructure, as a rule, leads to a decrease in the birth rate. And an increase in natural decline, death rate. New Russia is an ideological and an economic threat in an area obscure enough for Johnson's law to work. And this is why this latest call for war is taking place, at least indirectly, connected to eastern Ukraine. Now again, New Russia is on the front pages. Ukraine was a third world country before, at least since the 90s, and now is fourth world without their most profitable area. Without the East, Ukraine is in serious trouble. It loses the bulk of its industry, and it loses most of its resources. Oil and gas, the oil and gas in Kharkiv. As I said, it's about 60% of its GDP in exports. Not to mention half its territory. It's about 20 million people total. It's about 44% of its population. The country has the largest nuclear power plants are there, hydroelectric plants on the Dnieper. And so the rest of Ukraine would have no choice but to be totally dependent on Russia and Nova Russia. And Ukraine loses access to the sea. Pipeline and rail transit really ceases to function. So Ukraine, population-wise, would be like Romania. But it would be essentially at the level of Moldova, as several others have said before. And this is the problem. This is why there's a war there. We've talked about this on this show and elsewhere many times at great length. The war is ideological. The war is against the... ultimate, put it this way, the ultimate nightmare of Western capital is a Russo-Chinese bloc with a lot of allies, or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, with its own currency. It doesn't need the West for anything. The emerging markets, of course, are going to flow to there, slowly rendering the Western world irrelevant, at least not globally relevant. And of course, that's always been the problem. This is why the only time during the so-called Cold War that the U.S. would get all upset is if the Russian Empire is going to get too big. There's a chance that the dollar would be clipped out. Back in 2015, Putin gave an interview, and it's a bit disappointing. He said, There's no need for recognition of the Republic. The Minsk agreements that govern the ceasefire was only a document that was developed by, you know, Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany, but also in the United Nations Security Council. And he wants it fulfilled. And if that's carried out properly and the peace remains, then you can normalize the situation. And Lavrov said that more than anything else, Russia wants peace and security there. And some of them, you know, they don't want to keep united rather than to pull it apart. Even though Russians would be second-class citizens there, despite their economic superiority. But understand the ideological battle here. Understand that this is at the root of ideas. The Russo-Chinese bloc, now including Nova Russia, and the American one, which is dying and lashing out. That's the issue here. And then, of course, importantly, to restore the birth rate. This is what National Socialism is in the Slavic world. It's been done before. And you couldn't have a better enemy than the Ukrainian government. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.